I think one of the values of being quiet is that it takes you to the sweet ache. If you just empty yourself for a moment of the clutter of your life, the narrative that drives us, you'll feel drawn to a kind of quiet, a calm, an access point that takes you beyond the dimension of your interpretations and into the realm of space, into the realm of quiet. And if you're inclined to move in that direction without arresting the process of that prematurely, you'll find that something extraordinarily valuable opens up. Not necessarily according to our plans, not necessarily what we expected, but a dimension inside of us that's that we acknowledge, that we don't create. It's not created. If we go in that direction, we will put enormous distance between ourselves and this sweet ache. But if you just we just allow ourselves to see what's there without any sense of manipulation, you'll find it's almost drains everything from us that we had assumed our life to be about. It's almost like the ebbing can almost be felt as a draining away. What's left can be described in words as spacious. But each one of those is it's almost as if you were disrupting it somehow by calling it something. But what there is, the indelible imprint that's left, is it something truly authentic is there for us? Truly authentic. Again, acknowledged but not created. And then in the course of events, it all gets covered over very quickly. And the heart aches for it. Literally. It's been cut off from something that is essential. And the spiritual journey and its true orientation. Is a recovering of that, a rediscovery of it. And the ache, this differential between what I take myself to be in the clamor of my mental life, and the acknowledged blossoming of something much more vast, the gap between those two, is the spiritual journey. And if we pull up short, if we don't give our heart over to it, there's an ache. It tells us just that. Now, as I look at the way that the Dharma is unfolding currently in the West, I see a lot of ache. Because as the evolution of consciousness, remembering that what it means to awaken is that we move from the unconscious to the conscious. And that is affecting all of us. It's affecting the whole society, whether we're directly involved in the practice or not. It's affecting everything, which is why you see the polarization that we do. But where we're arresting our particular attention at this time, because of the darkness of the ignorance that has been invested in those areas for 200 years or longer, are areas of mostly relationship areas of polarization, areas of turmoil, areas of prejudice, areas of opinionation. And much of where the Dharma is going currently is to try to satisfy, to try to bring some understanding, to try to bring some conscious attention to those areas so that they can be satisfied sufficiently so that the Dharma can move on. It needs to move on. It cannot stay arrested in those areas because those areas are not in themselves satisfactory, regardless of whether they are completely resolved or not. They need to be addressed, but they will never bring us to contentment. And some of us are investing so much energy in the understanding of and the working out of those particular areas that you sense this great journey is being temporarily sidetracked. Which it is. It's not sidetracked in the sense that this shouldn't be done. It's sidetracked in the sense that there's too much energy focused on these particular struggles and not enough on the ache that leads us beyond struggle completely. And some of the players within those struggles have been arrested within their own pain and the pain that they've had to endure from prejudice of others for such a long time that the pain is so enormous that there is virtually nothing that anyone could do to alleviate it. And in some ways it's getting arrested. It's like a little eddy that just keeps turning around and around. When the true solution to this thing, the true solution to the end of prejudice, not the particular difficulties or historical tragedies that prejudice has caused, that can never be solved because it's over. But the true end to prejudice is to follow the ache, not the circumstances. But if you mention that, it's politically incorrect. But since I'm 68, I don't really care. Again, it's not that those struggles shouldn't be addressed, but we have to keep moving. And that does need to be addressed. I see and read now, and I think, where's the depth? Where's the depth? Yes, there's this, yes, there's that, but where is the depth? We can't ache without the depth. And the depth gives perspective to the whole struggle. That's what's so amazing. It doesn't bypass a struggle. It gives perspective to it. Doesn't bypass, it's not a end run around. I don't like the noise or difficulty of that conflict. It's not about avoidance. It's about perspective. It's the same perspective as many of us have discovered in our own Dharma practice, where we will be lost in some kind of emotional tension. And in some beautifully clear meditation, you will have perspective. You will see the emotion not from the personal animosity or difficulty or contraction, but from the space that perfectly allows that to occur without any personal involvement whatsoever. And suddenly, when that emotion comes up again after that particular depth of understanding, even though we may get lost within it again and again, not quite to the degree that we did when we didn't have perspective. Now think what that means in terms of the perspective of what you and I think we are and who we think we are embodied within, which is where all the turmoil comes from, where all the opinionation needs to be settled, where all the struggle needs to be worked out. And what if, for a moment, for just a brief moment, there is an awakening beyond that? So you could see yourself in perspective as a shift of identity out of that encased feeling of yourself. And then you came back into yourself. What then would you make of yourself and those struggles? It would be very different. So as we bring speakers, through the Dharma Center, see if the speakers touch your ache. Or they resolve some issue. Resolution of issues is fine, I'm not. But Dharma is not Dharma without the ache. That's all I wanted to say tonight. So let's just be quiet for 1 minute to give. And as you hold this stillness for 1 minute, let yourself plummet your depth. Feel the possibility. Sense it. This is the common heritage of all human beings who have resolved struggle. This sidetracks. This is not sidetracked. This does not avoid anything. This does not obscure anything. But it does handle everything from perspective. Okay, so with that, I open it up to any questions or comments from anyone. Yes.
I wanted to ask you how your retreat was, and if you have any insights that you can share with us.
So first of all, it's Bonnie that's speaking, and I want to say, before I get going here, and to thank Bonnie for her 6 weeks of joyful Dharma speaking. Thank you. Thank you. So I'm a little reluctant to share, not because I think it was so deep and profound that nobody would understand. It's just it's just that I don't want you to imitate. Right? Do you understand? So I'm going to talk about that for a moment, because that's an insight in itself. So this ache that's in us, if we truly follow it, has a navigation to it. It has a direction. It's not just a sore spot in our heart. It's an intelligent ache. And it knows when it's being satisfied, and it knows inauthenticity, and meanwhile, it's encapsulated with a lot of mental noise that often sidetracks the true direction the ache is taking, because we know better. We know how we really should, where we should go. Especially if somebody who you admire dharmically is going in the other direction. You think, well, then I'm obviously, you see that our pain body, what is just below the surface of our awareness is our psychological pain. Ready to follow its dictates, what it thinks is true. And what it thinks is true is that you aren't sufficient to make your own decisions about this. You don't have the wherewithal, the potential to really know your own heart. And that's been fed to us through countless years of parenting. And so when we are left to our own devices, we fall back to our pain, because that's the most comfortable area of us. It's the most acceptable area within us. And the pain that comes forth is the pain of doubt. And so I look at what I'm doing compared to what this person has written books. And I say, well, I need to do that. I need to do that. I need to do that practice. I need to do whatever that person is suggesting, because there's corruption from both sides often. A tremendous feeling of the ache of a Dharma teacher is psychological pain, is to have people to feel so empowered that I can tell each of you what to do. That gives me credibility internally when my own set of demons are not satisfied. So that's good enough, right? So it's mutual exploitation. But the barometer of true dharma in both people is not being lived. Because for truth, I do not have any idea what you should be doing. I can make suggestions, and if one feels right, then the ache will know its own way. And because problems are often similar and levels of experience are often common, then solutions sometimes are the same. But they're never always the same. And I can get so rote and conditioned in what I tell people to do that I don't bring that aliveness and understanding to the conversation. Right? So that's my job, is to stay fresh. Your job is to see whether what is being offered, if there is any resonance at all. Not just to swallow it whole. And that has, that's virtually the only compass we have. That's what makes this so difficult, is that we're not used to walking blind. It feels very much like that. As if all your senses were closed and you were asked to walk to your car. I have no idea how to get there. But there's a honing device within us that does. And it's not a mental overlay. It's not the usual way we intellectualize or figure things out. It's a deep sense within us of whether something is right for us or not. Hopefully, you found your way to this particular practice and it's right for you. And so then you navigate, okay, so that's, okay, so this feels right, this feels like, but your loyalty is never to the practice and it's never to the teacher. It's to that feeling of resonance. And so after X number of years or so, even though there's difficulty within any practice, there's also a sense of rightness within that difficulty. So even if it's difficult, it can feel right. So I'm not talking about whether it's easy, because no spiritual journey is linearly easy. But there's always a sense that this is the way I need to go. This is what I need to do. And that is what drives us forward. And if you stop or you veer away from that, there'll be this sense that most of us, most people, because you know, there's a well-known teacher there saying this, or saying that. And you begin to, well, maybe I ought to. So it's learning the vocabulary, the inward vocabulary of our own journey. And so I'm reluctant to share because I realize that it can be thought of as a model. What if I told you I went into that retreat not knowing what I was going to do? That's absolutely true. What if I told you I went into that retreat, cleared away all doing whatsoever? Where there's only time, right? No sitting, walking. What am I going to do? What am I going to do if I don't sit and walk? You see the predicament? like open space. How am I going to fill that time? That's a real question. What direction will my mind go when it's not pointed in a direction? See, the rug's pulled out from under us. I happen to love that. I want to be backed so far, backed up so far that I have nothing that I can reach for. It's because if I'm going to talk about spaciousness and timeless, the infinite, if I'm going to make this into a broadband, I better live it, hadn't I? Or it's hypocritical. So what is it like to live like that? See, I want to know that. Instead of timing my day to the meals, only an hour to go before lunch, or how many days left, were all the ways to validate your off time, all the echoes, all the authorities that validate, you know, through schedule, all of that's removed. And you don't bring it back. See, what does a retreat look like then? I kept saying to myself, if I did something or I did nothing, the time would pass exactly the same. See, if you do absolutely nothing, or you filled it with sitting and walking, it lasts exactly the same time. So am I willing to step out of it? So that's all I'll say about that one.
Just on what you just said, Rodney, it almost sounds like it's Ben Cohen when you said, if you're not sitting or walking, what are you? What are you? You can't even say it. I'm wondering about what I mean. It's a rhetorical question. What are you doing? What are you? But I remember what you said about one of our Sangha members who died, and she was asking, "What is it like to die?"
So the question, if I can just, if there's no sitting and walking, what? Don't you want to find that out? Don't you want to know what's behind all this? If you cleared everything out of the room, you see, how much are we dependent upon the things we do to call ourselves spiritual? The practices we offer, the states of mind we have. What if it didn't matter what the state of mind was? What if it didn't matter what the movement of the body was going through? You'll find that the most challenging question you can ever ask. I found it to be the most challenging question I could ask. Because it doesn't allow for anything to come in as an answer. Now listen carefully. Something comes in as an answer. But not until the other is shut down completely. So that if you just see, at that point is quiet enough. Not the pursuit of quiet, but that which comes in. Is that enough? And what about that which disrupts that? Is that enough? So that no matter what the configuration is that enough? See, these are Zen koans. Although I think I'm explaining it. So let me just answer that because there's the confusion about time and duration and how long. You see, that is an obstruction. Okay, I say this very gently because we live within our own obstructions. But that's an obstruction. Those are ideas that form our contingency plan. This is what I need to do plan. And we then work it, and then we then walk it out in that fashion. And we won't allow the fact that something could occur prior to the formation of that plan.
I'm not trying to be smart out or anything,
It's the wrong question, and I don't mean to be flippant. But you're asking, how can I do it? When that's the paradigm that locks us in to 40 years. Okay? When you don't have that paradigm to rely upon, I don't have time, I don't this, I don't have all that, you can feel the defeat within the conclusion. You see what it does? It does lots, but that's one thing it does. I don't have 40 years. I wish I'd started earlier, all of that. If that, when you, that no longer drives me now. So where's the 40 years? See, that was just an idea. That's how close this is. It what?
How individuals might manage or deal with prejudice. And I'm just kind of wondering what are your thoughts on engaging Buddhism and our responsibilities or efforts toward dealing with social injustice?
All of those are very important actions as long as they're being driven by depth. On this dimension that we normally operate, confusion reigns. And addressing any of those problems from confusion does not clear up those problems. Seek first the depth from which those problems are seen in perspective. And those problems can then be handled in a very different light than they can when they are just being reacted to from righteousness. And that depth is the first thing that must be addressed prior to the confusion that drives my life. You can't put the cart before the horse. Now, in the meantime, because none of us acknowledge the depth we have, because we have misplaced the ache of our heart, we try to go out and solve the problems because we feel very deeply about the problems. And feeling very deeply about the problems is part of the ache. But the way we handle that ache in response is way off center. So I'm not suggesting inaction prior to realization. I'm suggesting you use the interaction as part of the depth, a part of the journey into your depth, so that what the confusion is really what you're solving, your own confusion, as you lobby against climate disruption. You never lose sight of what drives the depth. Never. You do that, you're off base. You can call it Buddhist action, it's nothing. It is not Buddhist action. And I'm not saying it's wrong, just not saying that it's going to lead you to freedom.
So you're saying you don't believe in engaged Buddhism?
Is that what people heard me say?
No.
Ask somebody that just said no when we're out of here and see what they... I'm not going to go back into it because obviously I touched a sore point. Yes.
It's really interesting, this study in Dharma. And I totally see the perspective of knowing the mind, understanding the mind. And you do have to have the luxury, I believe, to have that kind of gamble, to sit, be quiet, to be alone. And the more you have that time, the more you understand, and the more you want to go into your knowledge. So you sort of have to disengage from your society in order to understand conditioning, anger, and fear, and all this stuff that you mind about.
In the beginning. Okay, so the question is about losing, really needing alone time in order to get this thing going and discover some of the insights. And I would agree with that for the most part, we need some alone time. Because if you just try to do it from engaged action. It doesn't, there's too much confusion going on. In the beginning, in particular, that alone time is important. To get a sense of what your priorities are more than anything, your intentionalities. Because what happens is that in normal engagement, we lose our intentionality. We try to live in accordance to our projection of what we see in the other person and what we want from the other person, and that gets too confused too quickly because that's been our life story. So we have to sort ourselves out. We have to develop some stability, some depth of quietude, some centeredness in ourselves so that we can handle what's coming in at us as that engagement occurs. And that does take time, and it does take time away for most of us, or at least it takes alone time. Right? At another point, what happens is that there is the stability of heart that learns as engagement occurs. Because now what's the central focus for that learning is no longer the satisfaction of our pain or the quieting of our pain, but rather the learning about the pain it's the releasing of the pain. It's the surrendering of those very qualities of mind and heart which have perpetuated us within that pain. And that you begin to see as essential. So you're drawn to interaction, but not for the same purposes that were there prior to the understanding of that, of how interaction can lead to insight. See that? So you do it prematurely, you think you're doing it, and you're not. You're just reinforcing the old stories within you, but it's, and you're kind of, you're compromising your depth for most of us, you're compromising your depth because you know that nothing is really happening if you're honest, which is that yearning inside that I spoke about. But it's more fun than being alone. And so we'll rationalize somehow that our spiritual practice is growing in that way when in our hearts we know it's not. You know? So for most of us, we have to take some time out. And we have to really want that stability. We want to have to know what's going on. We have to know what we want to know our role in things. What's my part in things? What part do I play in my own confusion? You have to want to know your part, your role. What's my role in my confusion? What's my role in this reactivity that's going on?
But it's interesting that the mind's default is unconsciousness, at least for me.
Is what?
Is unconsciousness rather than
awareness. No. No. The mind's default is where it's most comfortable. Okay. In the beginning, it's most comfortable to just continue on as you've always been, and that's unconscious. At some critical threshold, that's not okay, and you don't go there. And your default is no longer the repetitive patterns of your past, but the very act of awakening. And so there might be confusion, but the confusion is not tolerated. It does not in some kind of aversive sense. It's just not, has no thing, doesn't beckon you. So now there's just, you see, and so you're off a little bit and you start storing it, you know, story, and then it's like, it's like self-correcting. It does its own. It goes. It doesn't go there. And so, early on, the comfort level is to stay with the conditioning because it's easiest. It's easiest to do what you've always done. At some threshold, that's not tolerated, and that's where the switch occurs. And so, when you're relaxing and whatever, watching TV, there is, you don't lose consciousness.
But then there's a lot of effort when you don't.
No. It requires effort to be unconscious.
Okay.
Why would I say that? Huh?
At that point in your...
No, it always requires effort, at whatever point, to be unconscious. Because you have to grab something. Which is easier, grabbing something or not grabbing it?
There's a level of unconsciousness that you're neutral. To me, there's a level of unconsciousness that you don't, it's not that that's a thing.
Look very closely and you'll see you're grasping the neutral.
Okay, I don't do that.
You're milking it. This is so nice. Okay, y'all. Thank you. So, as I get older, you know, the fish in the fish line being reeled in, I don't have the play I used to have. You know, a lot of line, a lot of play. And so, if you come, you're going to get less and less play. That to me is the most beneficial thing I can give you. But you may not want that at all. And if you don't, it's fine. Seek your heart's intent. Okay.